It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Political groups with ties to billionaire Elon Musk are putting millions of dollars into the hotly contested Wisconsin Supreme Court race to boost canvassing efforts and air TV attack ads.
The April 1st election will determine the political direction of the high court in Wisconsin. Brad Schimmel, a Waukesha County judge and former Republican state attorney general, is backed by Musk-supported groups, among others. Schimmel's opponent is Dane County Circuit Court Judge Susan Crawford, who's been backed by the Wisconsin Democratic Party and sympathetic outside groups as well.
This could shape up to be the most expensive judicial election in U.S. history, and a campaign finance watchdog group has new estimates on the money flowing into this race. Nick Ramos is executive director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign. Nick, welcome back to Wisconsin Today.
Hey, it's a pleasure, and I just have to say there's only a few different stations and people that can get me up early, and while this is technically not early... I got to tell you, when I got the request, I was like, oh, tell me when, I'll be there.
Well, thank you. So break down the numbers for us. How much have these two campaigns spent so far? What is in their coffers?
Well, as of right now, and I'm looking at the numbers, and the minute that I say the numbers, I swear, tomorrow it's going to be in something entirely different. Mm-hmm. So just run with me for a second. So as of today... So far in this race, already $12 million in financial activity has been at least able to be reported as of right now. So liberal candidate Susan Crawford raised nearly $7.4 million, while conservative candidate Brad Schimmel brought in $4.9 million. $3 million of Crawford's money comes from the Democratic Party of Wisconsin. The Republican Party of Wisconsin has contributed about $1.68 million to Brad Schimmel's campaign. And then we're seeing crazy PAC activity, and we're watching – I mean, I think the last time I checked, I mean, we have seen max out contributions at a level that we have not seen at this moment in time. And so, like, I look, and I just want to take a quick peek at some of these numbers. So, like – some of the major contributions, and I'm looking at it right now, I mean, and let me tell you guys, this isn't all in-state money. There is a lot of out-of-state people that are on this list, but I'm seeing, it looks like over 20, I'd have to skim it real fast, but at least for Crawford, we're looking at, there are about 26 to 30 people that have maxed out, which is $20,000 for a Supreme Court race here. And then on Brad Schimmel's side, I mean, it looks equally as impressive. He's about 25 to 30 people have all contributed the max out of $20,000. But we all know, or if you don't know at home, just because you max out doesn't mean you have to stop donating. You can go to the party of your choice. You can go to the committee of your choice. And candidates like current Judge Schimmel, he said it in a town hall. He said, hey, guys, max out, then go to the party. They'll send me the check. And that's all legal here after Governor Walker.
You filed an ethics complaint. Your organization did. Is that right?
I did. And the reason why is, one, currently Brad Schimmel is a Waukesha County judge. And, you know, I'm an attorney. And I remember reading some of, like, the code when I was becoming an attorney. And it's very explicit. The Supreme Court wrote rules around how a judge is supposed to act while sitting and as a judge, but also as a candidate. And two pieces are crystal clear within the code. First part being that you cannot show even the appearance of impropriety. Now, what does impropriety mean? You have to show that, like, you can be fair, you can be impartial, and that your comments and your conduct do not lead somebody to believe that you could be bought, that you could be swayed. And so that's prong one. Prong two is Supreme Court races are so different than how we treat other races in this state, and that in other states, judges could directly solicit campaign contributions, not in Wisconsin. If you're a candidate, you have to have a proxy that represents your campaign that asks for the money. And the reason why is you don't want judges to appear that, like, oh, well, you know, you can pay to play any judge if you just give them enough money for their work offers, right? So we filed that complaint. And I have received correspondence from the Judicial Commission about it, and I need to follow up with them. And so that's as much as I can say about that right now, but I look forward to seeing what the commission is able to pluck from this, because we have the audio recordings that were all taken, and Daniel Bice reported on it, but we have evidence to believe at least the impropriety part of it was violated.
Back to the money here for a moment. This election, still weeks away, is it safe to assume spending will ramp up even more?
Yeah. I mean, for anybody at home that has been paying attention to what's been going on at the national level, I mean, Elon Musk is now in this race. And his PAC that is called Building America's Future and America PAC, I mean, they've already, if my numbers are correct, I counted about $3 million. And that just jumped from about a week ago. So the numbers that we're looking at right now, we're projecting this race to reach at least $75 million when it's all said and done, which would be a whole $20 million leap since the last time we had a Supreme Court race. But you can understand why. I mean, if you are a liberal voter in this state, if the liberal candidate wins, then you don't have to worry about ideological control being in the balance for another 2 years. Mm-hmm. Vice versa, if Judge Schimmel ends up winning and you're a conservative voter, then you're looking at it and you're saying, well, I mean, it's not the most comfortable place because we have another election next year. We have another Supreme Court. We have Supreme Court races every year till 2030. Yeah. But it does shift the ideological balance. And then you get opportunities to look at cases and be able to make decisions that, again, you don't need any swing vote, really. I mean, Brian Agedorn is the swing vote technically, but he's conservative.
We're talking about the money pouring into the state Supreme Court election, how it compares to previous ones. Nick Ramos with us tracks campaign finance at the watchdog group Wisconsin Democracy Campaign. Nick, we recently spoke with Lubar Center Research Fellow John Johnson at Marquette University Law School about state Supreme Court elections. You mentioned, you teased this here. He said the state is gearing up for a six-year stretch of annual state Supreme Court races. Let's listen.
Yeah, we have seven Supreme Court justices. They're elected to 10-year terms. And so we only had one in the last 4 years. That means we're about to have six more in a row. We're going to elect one Supreme Court justice each year now through 2030. And the way Wisconsin law is set up is you can only elect one Supreme Court justice in a given year. So that's why it's this back-to-back-to-back-to-back setup.
So this back-to-back-to-back-to-back, should Wisconsin expect all of these upcoming races to have record high spending? Where will the ceiling hit?
Well, first off, I just want to say I love John. You know, I'm a Marquette University Law School alumni. So, John, wherever you are, love you, man. To your question, unless we decide we want to do something different, and, you know, what is insanity? Doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result? Like, everybody knows it's a problem. We ran a money in politics poll statewide literally last week, and I can share that data with you. But I can tell you right now, demographically, Republican, Democrat, independents, doesn't matter, evenly split, 88% of Wisconsinites think that money is a problem when it comes to our politics. And then when you really get into the weeds, they start to really, I mean, people want to say the electorate's dumb. They are paying attention. I mean, they understand that at every level, money plays a key factor in what types of decisions are going to be impacted on our lives. And the most wealthy, and we're seeing billionaires starting to come into this election here, trying to buy a Supreme Court seat. Like, it's a situation where we want, doesn't matter the party affiliation, that people deserve more agency than what they're being given right now. And my hope is that people, including elected officials, can recognize that they don't want to keep being glorified telemarketers. And so, you know, my hope is that we are going to advocate and work hard to get public campaign finance reform in the state. And we're building a coalition right now. And last time we met, it was about 20 organizations. And we're going to go at this aggressively. And I think everybody, I think Republicans, Democrats, independents, I think they all would say, you know what, please. Like, I don't think we want to have to continue going down this rabbit hole. But in the same breath, they know the rules and they don't know how to stretch them. So, you know, it's going to take a lot of grassroots power to tell them, hey, people are paying attention and we want to change this.
So on this road to changing campaign finance here, I mean, we're seeing this influx of out-of-state money involving Wisconsin elections. Should we be more concerned about who is spending the money here, where it's coming from, and what it's being spent on?
Absolutely. I mean, the fact is that I'm not completely convinced that every active voter really understands and truly grasps grasp how much out-of-state money is coming in, especially when it comes to our Supreme Court elections. And, like, the fact that you have Elon Musk and his PAC getting ready, I mean, they're just starting with $3 million. There's going to be so much more down the pipeline. But then, I mean, on the Democrat side, you see, I mean, hell, Steven Spielberg, J.B. Pritzker, Reid Hoffman, you have, you know, they are always popping up on the Democrat side, and then the U-lines. And I'm trying to think about some of these other really big dollar donors on the conservative side, but they're not letting up because we are a litmus test. We are a bellwether state, and we are the first really big election in this country to test what the mood is as far as after the presidential election. So all these rich people, they're all like, well, you know, we're gambling here. We're going to see, you know, what plays and what can work on a national scale.
Does this sour someone who's listening to this thinking like, well, I'm not one of them. Should someone donate to a campaign or a political party if there's really not way of knowing how the money is being spent, or if there's such there's an influx of people who are ultra wealthy, you know, funding the campaigns?
Yeah, I mean, it's enough to make anybody jaded. I mean, and I don't blame people for being apathetic about our system because it is broken. And I mean, it's been broken since 2015 when Governor Walker rewrote our campaign finance laws. And then you pair on top of that Citizens United. But my thing is that I want to give people some hope. And the hope is that you are more powerful than you even know. And that, like, while money is, you know, something that can buy a lot of things, it cannot vote. And in your case, like, your vote is going to mean so much over these next 5-6 years, because there's going to be really big decisions, both in front of the judiciary and as far as our lawmakers. They're going to be making things that are going to impact your life, and you deserve to be educated about it. And so we are going to work our tails off to mobilize the people and show them their agency and show them what the path is forward, because we think we can get campaign finance reform done, and we're going to do it in the next couple of years. I promise you that.
Nick, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Nick Ramos is executive director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign. He was with us to discuss campaign finance ahead of the state Supreme Court election on April 1st.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, from calls to end the education department to executive orders that threaten funding cuts, find out how White House education policies could affect Wisconsin.
This is something that should happen over the span of, you know, several years, where there's some thoughtfulness given to, like, how this is going to work. And instead, what we have is mass chaos.
That's coming up next here on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. On Thursday, a Senate committee voted to advance President Trump's pick to lead the Department of Education. It's the latest in a push likely to shake up the department, tasked with sending billions of dollars to schools in Wisconsin and nationwide.
Education Secretary nominee Linda McMahon has said that she believes the department should be shut down. McMahon told lawmakers earlier this month that she only aims to reorient the department and wants to keep education funding created by Congress.
Eliminating the Department of Education would cause new uncertainty for funds going to more than 50 million K-12 students at nearly 100,000 public schools nationwide. These schools in Wisconsin receive around $1.6 billion from the federal government. That's just above 10% of total school spending in the state.
So what does all this mean for K-12 education here in Wisconsin? Alan Borsak is a senior fellow in law and public policy at Marquette Law School, and John Shelton is a professor and chair of democracy and justice studies at UW-Green Bay and vice president of higher education with the Wisconsin chapter of the American Federation of Teachers. I talked to them last week. I want to put an asterisk on this conversation right off the bat, in the sense that we're still watching plans take shape with some other cuts from the Trump White House. There's been some back and forth. And then, of course, there are lots of court challenges. And then there's Congress in this story, too. Okay. All that said, John, I want to start with you. Can you talk about the Department of Education and what Wisconsin schools get from it right now?
Yeah, well, of course, the Department of Education administers pretty much all of the federal education funding, which goes back to about the 1960s. The biggest thing that's involved in what the Department of Education administers are Title I funding. So this is funding that goes to disproportionately to schools that have the highest number of impoverished students. So it's about, I don't know the numbers for Wisconsin, but about 26 million kids in the country receive resources that are routed through Title I. Eliminating the Department of Education, whether that's through some kind of executive order that isn't litigated or, you know, the congressional law that's passed, would mean that funding presumably would be administered through block grants to different states, which would not necessarily guarantee that it would go to the places that it's intended to go. The other big thing would be students with disabilities. So, you know, the Department of Education administers resources for students with disabilities under the Individual Disabilities Education Act. And what that means is that funding would be routed somewhere else. It's unclear exactly where that would be, but it would make it more difficult for these funds to go to students who need them in our state. So, you know, I think the big issue here is that without the federal government kind of, you know, being the point to make sure that these funds are routed, there's less accountability and you know, less assurances that this funding is going to go to the students who need it.
Alan, when you look at Wisconsin, on the funding side of what the Department of Education does, are there districts or areas of the state that have more at stake here?
Well, I agree with what John said. Title I, for example, goes disproportionately by intention to districts with the most low-income students, and that would mean Milwaukee would have a big take here, and also some of the other larger cities in the state because they have the highest populations of low-income kids. The same with the IDEA, the disability funding. So what's going to happen, of course, we live in a period of extraordinary chaos. Linda McMahon, the designated person to be the Secretary of Education, she said in her confirmation hearings a few days ago that those streams of funding wouldn't be cut off. They might be designated to other departments, like who knows what, labor or something. And so as long as those two streams of funding continue, the impact on school districts in Wisconsin would be actually fairly small. Even overall, federal funding accounts for 10% or less of school funding in Wisconsin and in across the nation.
Right. And John, the Trump administration via executive orders has put strings on some of that federal funding related to the Trump administration policy on DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion formulas. How big an impact do you see that having? How much are schools at risk if they aren't careful to comply with those orders?
Well, Rob, I want to take a step back and just point out that, you know, there's such an enormous level of chaos that's part of this. And also, I think, cognitive dissonance around the very idea of the Department of Education. Right. So on the one hand, you have, you know, the Trump administration passing this executive order tasking the Department of Education with effectively coming up with a plan. I'll just simplify this for people. What the plan calls for is defunding schools, taking away federal funds from schools that don't abide by basically the Trump administration's view of how everything from, you know, history to civics should be taught. So you have that, but then at the same time, you have these calls to potentially eliminate the Department of Education. So it's hard to know exactly what the plan is. Is the idea for the federal government to increasingly meddle in school, state and local control of school curriculum, or, you know, is it to kick everything back to the states? And so I think the way to answer this question is that all of this chaos in terms of how we get federal education dollars to school districts that rely on them and states that rely on them is destabilizing everything. So I think we should actually be quite worried about what happens in terms of the Department of Education, you know, with all of these things in the next, you know, few months, because, you know, it's true that, you know, it's likely that much of this funding will continue to get to states like Wisconsin. But what is that going to look like? Is it going to be taken away from districts that supposedly don't teach the kind of patriotic education, I'm using that in quotes, that the Trump administration wants? Is there going to be any accountability in terms of making sure that resources go to the districts that are in most need? And these are the things that we just don't know enough about. And so, you know, if there was a long-term plan, say, to pass a law to eliminate the Department of Education, this is something that should happen over the span of, you know, several years, where there's some thoughtfulness given to, like, how this is going to work. And instead, what we have is mass chaos, which is no different than what we're seeing from this presidential administration in so many other sectors of American life. And it's hard for me to believe that that's not intentional.
Alan, are you hearing concern from school leaders in Wisconsin about that confusion, that uncertainty of what's going to happen in the next week, in the next couple of months?
Yeah, but not on these scores. On another really, really important and sensitive score, which is immigration. I've talked to several schools lately with high numbers of Hispanic kids and best as I know, high numbers of students that are undocumented. And people are just scared. The cool people are scared. The parents are scared. The kids are scared. And that's the number one worry related to Trump initiatives at the moment when it comes to ground level schools in that I'm familiar with, particularly in the Milwaukee area.
And that has to do with the change in policy on whether ICE can do enforcement in so-called sensitive areas, churches, hospitals, and, of course, schools.
Absolutely. Like I said, it's not an education department matter, but it is what's shaping education.
No, and Alan brings up such a good point there, because it, you know, we haven't even talked about that. And that's another, to my point, I think, that's another one of these destabilizing, chaotic elements, you know, and when you have an administration that basically says, yeah, we're going to open the possibility to go into schools where our, you know, the most vulnerable members of our societies, literally, you know, of our society, literally children, go to learn every day and go to be safe. And we're saying that we're going to allow ICE agents to go in there and round people up. You know, that's a major part of that destabilization. And when you combine it with, you know, the bluster about getting rid of the Department of Education, you know, this is a chaotic time. You know, what I hear from our members in AFT Wisconsin is just the level of uncertainty and fear that everything from, you know, having ICE go into their schools to, you know, not being able to, you know, have students with disabilities be able to get the resources that they need. That's all on the table right now.
Alan, are you hearing from schools that they're trying to figure out policies or clarify what, in fact, they would do if that ICE enforcement effort happens at their school?
There's so much uncertainty and there's so much trepidation. They're just, like I said, people are scared. So there, I was at a Catholic school on the south side of Milwaukee last week with a high percentage of Hispanic students and probably a high percentage of undocumented students. And they said they're trying to assure people what their rights are, what the school's going to do to try to help them and maybe even protect them. The limited right the school has to stop law enforcement agents coming in is a really forefront issue here. So far, nothing's happened as far as, you know, breaking into schools or churches or anything around here. But you can't just go to families and kids and say, don't worry, don't be scared, because they are scared. And given what's going on with the Trump administration, they have reason to feel that way. So that is, as I said, that's the biggest issue. If you're asking what's going on in schools at the moment, funding issues and Title I and such is a little more abstract and also more uncertain what's going to happen, less threat at the moment.
We're talking about Trump administration education policies, how they affect Wisconsin. We've got Alan Borsuk with us, senior fellow in law and public policy at Marquette Law School, John Shelton, professor and chair of democracy and justice studies at UW-Green Bay. And John, I think I heard you with a follow-up there.
Right now, one of the things that's happening at pretty much all of our locals is planning to figure out what happens if ICE comes to their school. How do we, as teachers and other educators, collectively advocate for our students and you know, make sure that, like, our parents know when something like that happens, to make sure that our teachers know what they actually legally have to comply with. And our national union, American Federation of Teachers, has done a lot of things to put out a lot of resources for people to know exactly how to engage with this with students. So, you know, there's a lot of uncertainty, but we're not just sitting around trying to see what's going to happen and react to it. Like, we're putting things in place right now to protect kids, because that's what we do as educators. That's what we do every day.
I want to dig into a couple other education issues of the Trump administration making the case for more private school options, school choice options. The president's choice is a secretary of education. He nominated Linda McMahon, a supporter of alternatives to public education. John, a lot of these policies are set at state levels. How much leverage does the federal government have to promote education other than public schools?
Well, there's some leverage certainly in terms of funding. So the executive order that you just talked about basically says that any level of discretionary funding that the education department has, they're going to pump that into support for voucher schools. So there's some powerful, both in terms of resources and there's a powerful sort of signaling feature of that executive order, and certainly what I think we all know Linda McMahon is going to push for as education secretary as long as the department's around.
Alan, Wisconsin has a long history with vouchers. Milwaukee, the program, they're one of the earlier adopters, since been expanded into other programs. Do you see much that the federal government would do to expand that even more in Wisconsin potentially?
Frankly, I think I understand the Wisconsin situation pretty well, but I'm totally confused by what's going to happen nationally and what impact it's going to have. I mean, there's not going to be like a major appropriation from Congress to foster voucher programs. That's just not going to happen. But the control through rules and regulations, frankly, threats and forcefulness, it's really unclear to me what's going to happen. I don't think there'll be that much change in Wisconsin as far as the school choice, either vouchers or charters, scene, because we have such large and vibrant sectors for those here, among the most significant and consequential in the country. But if public schools, for example, are threatened that they'll lose funding if they don't adopt this policy or that policy, things related to DEI, things related to school choice, whatever, it could be important, but it's just chaos at the moment. It's so unclear what's really going to happen. And so much of it is outside of the process that we always thought we had. I mean, if Congress had to act on whether to abolish the Department of Education, it wouldn't happen because they don't have 60 votes to stop a filibuster in the Senate. I mean, I think it's as simple as that procedurally. And we're not, Trump is basically going totally around Congress and running over Congress. So will that actually have any applicability? Nobody quite knows.
John, another role of the Department of Education is being kind of a watchdog for civil rights as it applies to students and education. Are you concerned, again, with the uncertainty here of what, if absent a Department of Education, if that job is being done by the federal government?
Rob, I'm glad you mentioned that because, you know, I kind of tried to distill things more earlier, but that would have been the third thing that I talked about, you know, coming out of the 1960s and, you know, the Elementary and Secondary Education Act and this sort of Civil Rights Act era, accountability for enforcing civil rights in our schools is vested with is now vested. I mean, the Department of Education wasn't around at the time, but it's precursor, vested with the task of enforcing those civil rights. And, you know, I think Alan really hit the nail on the head. I mean, so many things are kind of up in the air right now. You know, the question is, I mean, presumably if the Department of Education were eliminated, whether through an executive order or through an act of Congress, you would see presumably civil rights enforcement go to some other federal agency, but it's unclear what that would be.
Alan, as we wrap up, in your mind, what is the biggest open question right now as far as what's going to come out of the Trump administration and Congress and how it's going to affect education in Wisconsin?
It's me because it's just so confusing and chaotic and uncertain and unclear. I mean, what's really going to happen is hard to predict, but that uncertainty itself takes a big toll. And I do want to return to that immigration issue. That may be the biggest thing that's going to happen in the lives of lots of kids and families and communities. If Title I continues, if IDEA continues, if Pell Grants continue, we haven't mentioned those. You know, those are the bulk of the federal money, but the initiatives, we were talking about civil rights here, President Trump has made it very clear what he feels about civil rights enforcement, and it ain't pretty from the standpoint of people who are fond of the heritage of civil rights enforcement from the Department of Education. It's like not going to happen. So there's just so many things to be fearful of, or to be, if you're inclined, thrilled about. But what a climate we're in. It's just chaos.
And we'll leave it there. Alan, thanks for joining us today.
Glad to be here.
And John, thanks for being with us.
This is a really important conversation. Thank you, Rob.
Alan Borsuk is a senior fellow in law and public policy at Marquette Law School, and John Shelton is a professor and chair of democracy and justice studies at UW-Green Bay. He's vice president of higher education with the Wisconsin chapter of the American Federation of Teachers. We talked last week about changes in federal education plans and what they mean for schools here in Wisconsin.
And now we'd like to hear from you. Have you been affected by frozen federal funds, or are you a federal worker who has been laid off? WPR's Wisconsin Project wants to hear from you.
You can visit WPR.org to fill out a short questionnaire. Tell us how your work has been affected by cuts to federal funding, or if you're a federal government employee who's lost your job, you can share your story there as well. What does all this mean for you personally? What are your concerns for the field you work in and potential effects on public services? Again, you can find and fill out that questionnaire online. It's at WPR.org. That's WPR.org.
Still ahead on Wisconsin Today, the comedian and actor Kevin Farley has a new graphic novel about growing up in Wisconsin with his late brother, comedy legend Chris Farley.
In Wisconsin, you know, when we couldn't go outside because it was too cold, we stayed inside, and there was always a competition, you know, who could make each other laugh the most.
Growing Up Farley, that's next from WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. In 1993, the late comedian, sketch comedy actor, and Madison native Chris Farley burst onto the stage of Saturday Night Live as motivational speaker Matt Foley, giving one of the most famous sketch comedy performances in SNL's 50-year history.
Well, I'm here to tell you that you're probably going to find out as you go out there that you're not going to amount to jack squat! You're gonna end up eating a steady diet of government cheese and living in a van down by the river.
Now a new graphic novel from Chris's brother, Kevin Farley, is a flashback to their youthful coming-of-age comedy adventures.
From their boyhood, their boyhood skits at Red Arrow Camp at the Northwoods to sets in the converted garage of Arc Improv Theater in Madison.
The graphic novel is called Growing Up Farley. The book's illustrator, Ryan Dunleavy, says he could relate in many ways to the panels he drew.
And I just felt like I was acting out, reacting with Kevin's stories. I was reacting stories and things I did with my brother at the same age, just with a pencil rather than up on a stage.
Chris Farley died of a drug overdose in 1997, but Farley, the big guy with a big personality on SNL, was once a Wisconsin kid doing pranks with his brother Kevin.
We got to see Chris before he became famous, before me and the rest of the world knew about him. I hope people can see, just find something of themselves in the book, kind of the way I did when I was making it.
Dunleavy's illustrations are paired with words by comedian and actor Kevin Farley. I asked Kevin how he chose what stories to share from his childhood and the role his father had in getting the Farleys into the world of comedy.
I wanted to give people a glimpse of, you know, what inspired me and how it all came to be, you know, and it really came to be during my childhood, and it developed during that time. And so I wanted to give people sort of an inside scoop on what happened when we were growing up.
I want to start with your dad, and we get glimpses of who he is, you know, selling asphalt. What impact did he make on your comedy?
A lot, you know, pretty much everything. He had sort of a sometimes dry sense of humor. He was, but when he'd laugh really hard. You know, he was inspired by a lot of the Mel Brooks's comedies, and really the only movies my dad would let, where everybody would watch, let everyone watch, are comedies. So we were flooded with Caddyshack and Carol Burnett Show and basically those kinds of comedies like Saturday Night Live. And yeah, we were always watching movies. We watched them over and over again. You know, we had a VHS player and we could watch them over and over again. So I think we watched Caddyshack over 1,000 times. I don't know. Yeah. And so that's kind of where the inspiration came. He was a guy that really loved comedy. We didn't really watch anything else growing up. We never talked about anything else. We always talked about who was the funniest.
There's the big block lettering with those like refrigerator magnet look to the letters. And it says, "I have never laughed so hard as when I was laughing with my brother." Can you describe how close the two of you were, the sibling bond of the Farleys?
He and I were in school together all the way. In school, we went to high school, we went to college together, and we played rugby together, we played football together, and we worked for my father. And then, you know, he went to Second City and I went to Second City. So we were kind of attached to the hip pretty much all of our lives. When, you know, in Wisconsin, you know, when we couldn't go outside because it was too cold, so we stayed inside, and there was always a competition, you know, who could make each other laugh the most. And he usually won those competitions because he one-upped everybody, you know. We would dare somebody to do something, and he'd always do it.
That's what I found so interesting that I didn't know, the stories of you and Chris, you know, Chris being so competitive. And I'm wondering, did that drive, did that fire in the belly, you know, of wanting to be the best at something, did that come through in Chris's comedy work?
Oh, yeah. You know, he thrived on that where, and that was kind of growing up. We would have Monopoly games or basketball or any kind of athletics, anything but academics, really. We didn't really care about academics. But I think he wanted to be a pro football player for a little while. And then when he found comedy, he wanted to be the best. He always wanted to be the funniest guy in the room.
In the book, you talk about Red Arrow Camp in northern Wisconsin, going there in the summers. What role did summer camp have in you both getting your first taste of performing for a crowd?
Yeah, well, we would always go up to summer camp when we were little. You know, pretty much every year we'd go during the summer. Red Arrow always had like a play at the end of the summer, and everybody in the camp had a little something to do there. I was mostly in the choir, but Chris always had a lead role. And he sang songs like Teddy Bear by Elvis, and he really killed in that one. And he sang all different songs, and he was always the hit of the play. So we kind of knew there was something there at that point, you know.
So when he starts performing as Matt Foley, that abrasive and clumsy motivational speaker, I'm wondering what you thought of watching that, what you saw in him as he came to life in those performances.
Well, yeah, we had just discussed that a lot, and we had a lot of football coaches that were kind of loud and boisterous, and they were hilarious because of the way they spoke, you know, and the coach would always say, "Do me a favor, don't think, do," and that kind of thing. And those kind of sayings always always resonated with Chris. Like, if you're going to make a mistake, make an aggressive mistake. And that he loved the football coach's sayings, you know. And then a lot of it was mixed in with my father and his boisterous kind of voice. So it was a combination of our football coaches and my dad.
You two moved out of Madison in early adulthood. And how did your relationship with Madison, even with Wisconsin, change as you became an adult and as you went off in Chicago, big cities, and leaving Wisconsin behind in some respects?
Oh, it's kind of sad. You know, I love Wisconsin. And I always look at Wisconsin kind of like, remember in The Hobbit, the Shire and the Hobbit? You know?
Yes.
I always think of Wisconsin like that, with a bunch of like hobbits running around with giant feet, just eating cheese and planting food. And, you know, just friendly people, you know. And so it was like I felt a little bit like Bilbo Baggins leaving the Shire. You always wish you could go back and just eat cheese and watch the cows, you know.
I appreciate how this graphic novel really focuses on special relationships and the things that the behind the scenes things we just don't see between brothers and your dad, and we don't see the struggles that are often focused on with food or alcohol, the drugs. And I'm wondering, you know, do we shy away sometimes from the good points and the relationships that seem to get, you know, short shrift?
Yeah, I mean, my brother died a very public death, and everybody knows how he died, and we talk about that a lot. But I always wanted to show people, you know, the other side of him, which you know, was a pretty shy guy, and a lot of times very insecure. And my father also had an illness. He was overweight, and we all had a problem with food. I still do, you know, and alcohol. But, you know, you have to address those issues. And, you know, since then, we've all looked at ourselves. You know, I've looked at myself, and I've sobered up. And so I look at that as something that's, you know, was in the family. And was, you know, something we all had to address, you know. Mm-hmm. And I didn't really know what alcoholism was, you know, when I was growing up. But then I figured it out pretty quick after Chris died, you know. Mm. So I wanted to just point, you know, the good things. And because there's so many times people focus on the troubles Chris had and my father had. But, you know, I wanted to, there was also a lot of good times too, you know.
I love the words at the end of the graphic novel. Your dad saying to be polite, look presentable, and be open to everyone with civic mindedness. Did you and Chris grow into these values, or how do you hold that guidance now inside of you?
Well, the one thing he wanted to impress with his boys is to be a gentleman. Hmm. And that meant, you know, have some manners, even though it didn't seem like Chris, but he would have manners sometimes. And he always wanted to his boys to look decent, you know, wear a blazer, you know, khaki pants or gray pants. And he wanted everybody to be a gentleman and always listen and have your manners when you're talking to people. Don't be a jerk to people. And he insisted on that. He didn't like bullies, and he didn't like people that were too showy, you know. He wanted you to be like any kind of Wisconsin dad, sort of grounded in Midwest values, you know, sort of.
It makes me think about the scene in the graphic novel where you and Chris, you're in the family car, you're riffing about someone who appears to be homeless, and your dad screeching to a stop and just has had enough, saying the worst thing you can do is diminish someone because it diminishes all of us. What was that moment like for you two?
Well, we were Catholic. It was very important to be Catholic and to be religious in our house. We all were altar boys, and it was very important for my dad to send everybody to Catholic school. And he really drilled into us the importance of Catholicism and Christianity. And so if we veered along out of that world, he'd get very angry, and he didn't like that.
Considering the Catholicism, you end with the Clown's Prayer. And I understand Chris kept that with him, that prayer. Can you reflect on that, what the Clown's Prayer means to you now?
Yeah, there was a priest in Marquette named Father Naus, and he was a clown in his, like he was an actual clown that, I don't know if he worked for the circus or he'd do certainly appearances and stuff. A very gentle, nice man. And he was a great priest that was in Marquette, and he had that. I don't know if he wrote it, but he introduced Chris to that prayer, and it always, since Chris was, you know, inspired to go into comedy after college, he always kept that with him, that, and I always remembered that prayer. So that kept him also grounded, you know, into Christian values.
I've been thinking about you in the passage of time with SNL celebrating 50 years and such a big celebration with that, and it being more than 25 years since Chris died. As you look back at so many years and watch what SNL has gone through with talent, how do you hold that in you? What do you think about?
Oh, I think about it. I watched the 50th, and I thought it's just great memories. I remember being around. I'd go visit, and I'd see go around 8H and see all the people I admired, and it was just an electric place to be. And so it was nice to watch, you know, but it's also bittersweet because of that was such a nice period in Chris's life, and Chris had such a huge part of it, so it was it's very meaningful.
Well, Kevin, it's been a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much for joining us.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much. And I love Wisconsin, and it's a pleasure very much.
Kevin Farley is a comedian and writer. He's the author of Growing Up Farley. It's a graphic novel that is a glimpse into Chris and Kevin's comedy adventures growing up in Madison. Ryan Dunleavy is a comic book artist in New York. He illustrated this book.
Hey, buddy, life's moved on, but you still bring us so much joy. Make my kids laugh with your YouTube clips, oh, Tommy Boy. You're a legend like you wanted, but I still wish you were here with me. And we were getting on a plane to go shoot Grown Ups 3. Yeah, life ain't the same without you, boy. And that's what I'm singing about. I'm singing about my boy, Chris Farley. And if we make...
You're listening to Wisconsin Today on the new-ish WPR News Network, and we're glad you're here with us.
This service is listener-supported. We have a one-day member drive coming up next week, but you can help right now.
Help us get a great head start. Be one of 600 people to donate before the 6th, and a generous group of members will give an additional $10,000 for WPR programs.
Join in now at WPR.org/donate, and thank you so much for your support.
Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at WPR.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to WPR News.